morning, church.
Morning.
Thank you, Pastor Jeff and Gail, for the kind invitation to continue to come back here. And happy Veterans Day to everyone. We all know that normally Veterans Day messages come on the week before Veterans Day, so we're kind of ending Veterans Day. But what many of you may not know is Veterans Day week also shares the Marine Corps birthday. And being a Marine, I had to celebrate the Marine Corps birthday last weekend. I was at Marine Corps Recruit Depot, which is Marine Corps boot camp on the West Coast. There's two of them, Parris Island and San Diego. And so I was there as the guest speaker for the Marine Corps birthday ball. And also, the following Sunday morning, I got to speak to the recruits there, those who are going through Marine Corps boot camp. I spoke to several thousand of them. I've been doing it for 5 years now, where I go every quarter and speak to the new recruits about spiritual resiliency. The Marine Corps allows me to do that and give them books on the path to resiliency, on actually their spiritual resiliency to become Marines and be combat ready and resilient warfighters because of their relationship with Christ. And I'm so honored to do that. I've spoken to thousands of those guys. But this last Sunday was so special because while I was there speaking, one of the recruits was my youngest son, Hayden, who some of you know. And I got to be there and speak with him. And we got to sneak in and actually get to talk to him, which is kind of cheating. But those are the perks and privileges of being there. But anyway, it was just so amazing to be there with him. And in fact, he's our... my father was a Marine who went through San Diego. I went through San Diego as well. My oldest son, Hunter, who's here with us today, went through San Diego, and now he's my youngest son, Hayden, is the fourth one. So it's a very, very special day for me. And Veterans Day week is always a special day for me, and I think it should be special for every believer, because for believers, it's the right to be here this morning and freely worship is of all the rights, I think, the most special one that we share. And I think as we live in the United States, we could become very complacent and very naive to the fact that we're part of only 20% of the entire world. Think of that. We're only 20% of the world that is allowed to freely do this. And we're able to freely do this because of brave men and women who put on that uniform since 1775 and went and stood for our rights and our freedoms and to protect us and keep us safe, but mainly to be able to preserve freedoms such as this to be here today. And as Pastor Jeff said, that right and that freedom comes at a cost, and that cost sometimes comes through death of our warriors, some being physically wounded, some being emotionally wounded, and many, many, whether they were in a relationship with Christ or not, being spiritually wounded. And with all those problems that we see our veterans face, some of the problems that Pastor Jeff talked about, the good news is there is a solution, and that solution comes with the relationship with Christ. And I want to share how Kathy and I found that solution in our own journey of coming out of the darkness of some of the things that many military warriors face. And I want to start off with a story I love to share, probably one of my favorite stories of Afghanistan. And it's my job in Afghanistan was a little bit different. I was a Force Recon Marine, which was Special Operations in the Marine Corps. I was very privileged to try out and accepted on what's called a JSOC Task Force, a Joint Special Operations Command Task Force, working with all the different special operations coming together on one common mission. And my job is what's called an AFO, Advanced Force Operator, was to go out and kind of blend in with the locals in one or two-man teams, working with local nationals, and kind of get to dress like the locals and grow a big beard, big nasty beard, and live in their homes and hang out with their families and really go in and set up all the operations for our task force. And so that's what I did. So as you might imagine, you know, life as a special operations guy in a place like Afghanistan and being with a big team, that wasn't really my job. In fact, I have a picture here of what I might have looked like there. I'm the guy without the square glasses on. And that's kind of like everyday life. And so this particular story I want to share with you, I was with one other teammate. We were kind of dressed like this. We're in a Toyota Prado, which is like a Toyota 4Runner. And we were driving on a road called Jalalabad Road, heading into the eastern side of the capital city of Afghanistan. The city's name's Kabul. And as we're driving towards Kabul, we noticed a truck following us. We thought it was following us. It was a Hilux pickup truck, which is like a typical Toyota pickup truck. And it was loaded with guys that looked like stereotypical Taliban. I mean, these guys had big beards, tribal clothing on. They had AK-47 assault rifles. We even seen one RPG, which is a rocket-propelled grenade launcher. And they were, like, loaded in this truck. To give you an idea of how many were in there, we always had this joke we'd say, how many Taliban can you fit in a pickup truck? So the answer is one more, right? They, like, pile in this truck. They're hanging out the sides. Maybe one guy on the roof. We're like, man, I hope these guys, because they look like they're up to no good, I hope these guys aren't following us. And so we did a technique that I learned in training called deviating your route. So I'm on Jalalabad Road and I make a right off the block, and they continue to follow us. And as I continue to make that intersection and come back to my original route, when I turned right back on that original route and they turned and followed me, it indicated to me that they were in fact following me. But I also let them know that I knew that they were following me, which started a pretty aggressive pursuit. They started chasing us and really very aggressively. And I had to make a decision. I had to choose between going kind of out in the open country and trying to lose them or going into the city and trying to lose them. Now, I don't know, you know, well, I do know you guys live in the Woodlands. You guys think you have bad traffic. Well, there's nothing on third world traffic. No stoplights, no street signs. Kabul traffic is just insane. And I knew the city. I thought I could lose them because that's why I actually lived in that city at that time. I thought I could lose them, but the traffic began to make it very difficult. And we have a picture here of the traffic, how kind of looks in Kabul. This is probably like an understatement, but it's the only picture I could find. And so the traffic got really congested. I got this major intersection called Masood Circle. And as I got to Masood Circle, the traffic just stopped. And all of a sudden, I didn't have any place to go. Somehow that truck managed to get through that traffic and get in front of us about 20 yards and cut us off in like this roadblock situation. And I remember vividly the passenger stepped out. You could tell he was in charge. He stepped out of the passenger side door. He calmly shut his door. He had AK-47 in one hand. He picked up his hand to me and made eye contact and put his hand up for me to stop my vehicle. A very bad situation. In my training and experience, this is called being stuck on the X. The X is it's an ambush site. It's a kill zone. A couple of rules you learn in training about the X is rule number one is you have to be able to recognize that you're on the X. Right? You got to know you're in a bad situation. Rule number two, pretty simple. You have to get off the X. You got to move or something bad's going to happen. And so I'm so thankful for military training and you train for every type of scenario that you could possibly face in combat. And actually, we train for this scenario every year. I go to a place called Bill Scott Raceway. We crash cars and do counter-pursuit training. And so we trained for a roadblock situation before. I knew exactly what to do, a ramming technique. I hit the guys and aimed my vehicle towards theirs. Probably one of my favorite memories of Afghanistan is when I smashed into that truck and it spun out of the way with seeing little Taliban guys fly out the back through the air. And a few of them jumped before I hit them. But as I knocked that truck out of the way, there was like this perfect pathway to get off that intersection. And then there was one more obstacle. There was like this 100-year-old policeman with this perfect uniform on. Anybody that's been overseas, you know, like these traffic cops, they like, that's their job. That's their life is these intersections. And he like owned this intersection. He has whistle and he was taking charge, man. He was like blowing his whistle. He's trying to stop me. He's like, beep, beep. And the good thing about Afghans, why they survived thousands of years of war, is they always jump on a winning team. And so when he saw that I was going to run him over to get out of there, he actually jumped on my team and started blowing his whistle, stopping cars, directing traffic, and got us off the intersection and probably saved our life that day. And I don't know what those bad guys wanted that day on Masood Circle, but I do know this. If we would have stopped on Masood Circle, if we would have stopped on the X, we probably would have put up a heck of a fight. But the truth is, we likely would have been killed or taken. And I'm here to tell you this morning that you don't have to go to Iraq or Afghanistan to find yourself on the X. I'm sure everyone can recall a time in their life where they found themselves stuck on an X in their life. You know, maybe you're on it today. I mean, look at what's going on in the world right now. The chaos of the election, of COVID, of lockdowns, the economic impact on jobs and all kind of stuff is going on right now. I imagine plenty of us are feeling the hopelessness and despair that could come with the pressures of this world. The question in life isn't if you're going to find yourself on the X, because you will. It's when you do, what are you going to do? And what I've learned through my own experiences in my life and the experience of the last 10 years of working with thousands and thousands of military warriors who suffer with combat trauma, essentially stuck on the X, I've learned it comes down to one thing, and that's a choice. A choice that we make to decide whether we're going to stay on the X's in our life and die, either literally or metaphorically, or if we're going to choose to get off that X and move forward into the very lives that we were created to live. You know, God didn't just create us, but he created us for a purpose, and I'm very thankful for that. And he has a plan and promise for our lives. In Jeremiah 29:11, it says, "For I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you, not to harm you. Plans to give you a hope and to give you a future." When you find yourself on the X in life, if you press forward trusting that promise that God has for us, you will find victory in the battles of life. It may not look the way you think it's going to look all the time, but if you stay in the center of God's will, you will land in the right place. Now, I wish I could come up here and tell you guys that I always moved forward when I found myself on the X, or that I trusted or even knew the promises of God, but that's just not the case. In 2007, I came right back here to the Woodlands and found myself on the X again. I was diagnosed with PTSD, And my life was probably on the worst exit I could possibly be on. And I didn't follow those two simple rules. Number one is I didn't identify that I was on the X because of pride or shame. Whatever reason, I wouldn't admit or recognize the situation I was actually in and the dangers of it. And because of that, I made a choice and decided to stay on the X for a period of almost 3 years. And I'll emphasize that I chose to stay there for a period of almost 3 years. And it almost cost me everything. And if I look back at my story and the hardships of my life, they really didn't begin in Afghanistan. They begin for me in a kind of a military journey back with my father. As I mentioned when I began today, my father was a Marine in Vietnam. He was an infantryman. He came home and struggled with a lot of the same things a warrior struggle with today. He was a very angry man, a very violent man, a lot of alcohol, womanizing. And there was a lot of physical abuse in my home. And I don't mean spankings with a belt. I'm kind of cool with that. My son will tell you. But I'm talking about fist-to-face physical abuse. And that's not okay. We all know that. And that's the kind of household that I grew up in. And if anybody's ever grown up in a household like that, you know that your siblings get really close. And so my brother, he was a year older than me, and we kind of bonded through that dysfunction in our home. And when we were about 13 and 14 years old, we lived in southern Louisiana. We decided we were going to join the military to escape that lifestyle, to really have a fresh start for our own. And we were always like playing in the woods and swimming in the bayous. And I remember we were watching this Navy SEAL video, and this guy came out of the water, and he had like scuba gear on and an M16 rifle, and he had seaweed hanging off his head. And I'm like, I want to do that. That's what I want to do. And but I didn't want to join the Navy. Sorry to my fellow sailors out there. I want to be a Marine, and the reason I want to be a Marine is probably because of this. My father was just such a broken person, but the only time I seen him smile, the only time I seen him proud, the only time I seen him happy was when it came to the fact that he was a United States Marine. And I was like, if that can make that guy like happy and proud of something, I want to do that. And so I learned about being a recon Marine, special operations in the Marine Corps, and me and my brother set a goal that that's what we were going to do. We started running and swimming. We were about at 13 and 14 years old, and we trained for about a year together, and then tragedy hit our family. My brother, he was shot and he was killed. And it was devastating to me. He was the closest person to me in my life at that time. And I went into a really deep depression. We didn't have the same biological mother, but she was not able to handle that. She just mentally just collapsed. My father didn't want to deal with it. He took a job overseas and abandoned us in that situation. And so at 15 years old, me and my older sister found ourselves living alone, trying to fend for ourselves. By the time I was 17, I probably wasn't going to graduate high school. But I was still focused on that goal in the military. I was running and swimming and preparing myself. And I went to a Marine Corps recruiter. I'll never forget his name, Staff Sergeant Brown, because I think he saved my life. And I pled my case to him, told him the situation I was in, and he helped me get in the Marine Corps at 17 years old with a high school diploma. I made a promise I'd get my GED as soon as I got in, and I did. And all these years later, I have an MBA. I can't spell MBA, but I got one. I always think about the military and a second chance of life it gave me. And for so many young people, it gives us a second chance and a clean slate. And for some reason, at the young age of 17, I recognized the opportunity and said, I'm going to totally embrace this opportunity, this total, like, new beginning. And I totally embraced it. I went after that goal to become a recon Marine. It's very difficult. Any special operations path is usually about 80% attrition rate. And at a young age of 18 years old, I made it. And it was an incredible experience. Lots of great jobs in the military. Any job in the military is essential to the overall mission, and I'm thankful for all the jobs. But for me, there was probably no greater job and opportunity to be a reconnaissance Marine. I loved it, and I wanted to do it. When I say I wanted to do it, I actually wanted to go to war and do it. And some people might understand, especially some of the ladies sometimes, like, why would you want to go to war? My wife asks the same question. The only way I know how to explain it is, like, imagine if you got, like, a really nice outfit, and you get all dressed up, and you get your hair done, but you don't have anywhere to go, right? You get all dressed up and no place to go. That's just like being in the military. You train and train and train, and you don't have any war to go to. Like, what am I doing? So that's kind of how I felt. Unfortunately, that opportunity came at the cost of 9/11. I remember when those planes flew in those World Trade Center buildings. I was assigned to 3rd Force Recon Company at the time. And I remember watching on television, and my wife and I knew our life's about to be different. You know, it's about to be radically changed. And no one was looking at the military like, oh my gosh, we're going to war. Everyone was looking, going to their units like, hey, what's up, sir? Like, when are we going to do this? The military is motivated. We want to go set the record straight and right that wrong. And we did. And I got the opportunity to try out for the JSOC task force. I remember going to Afghanistan the first time. and landing in Bagram Air Force Base in the middle of the night. And I didn't go with my unit, so I actually met my unit there. And so I had some time, like when I first got there, it was in the middle of the night, and I walked over to the edge of the base, and I remember there was like these HESCO barriers and concertina wire on the top. And I remember thinking like, oh my gosh, like this is real. I wasn't a kid. I was 28 years old or so, and I'd been in the military for a while. I had a lot of training experience. I was thinking, this is real. Like, I've been training my whole life to do this, and it's going to happen. Like, beyond this fence is the Taliban, the bad guy, and they're going to try to kill me over the next months, and I'm going to try to do the same to them. And that was my thought. And anybody in that, I think, in that position would ask themselves the question, am I ready? Am I ready to do what I was trained to do? And I asked myself that question at night. And it maybe not go down like this, but I think about the pillars of resiliency in the military and the way you should self-evaluate if you're ready to do a job like that. The military has four pillars of resiliency: mind, body, spirit, social. Am I mentally tough enough to do this? Mentally prepared? Am I physically prepared to do this? Do I have a strong spiritual foundation? And am I socially connected? Do I have the right people around me? I would have said yes to all those things. In fact, when it came to the spiritual piece, the word Christian was stamped in my dog tag, so I was like, check, like good to go. But the truth is, I had no idea what it meant to be a man of God or a person of faith. In fact, I believed that I had to make a choice between being a person of faith and being a Christian and being a warrior. I had this view in my mind back then that I believed that men in church and Christians were weak. I went to church right here in the Woodlands, and I go every Sunday morning, and I went probably to more to manipulate my family. Looking back, my wife's going to go, and she's going to be the virtuous woman and good and loyal and faithful and all those things, and my kids are going to go to Sunday school, and they're going to be disciplined, and I'm not going to have to beat them so much because they're going to be good, right? But I wasn't going to join the softball team, just say that, and I wasn't going to any Bible studies or anything like that. Sunday morning was the check in the block for me, and so I really didn't have a relationship with God, and so because of that, I felt like, people of faith were weak, and I have to be a warrior, so I have to choose between masculinity and Christianity. And I'll tell you, if we could time out for a second, men, there is no bigger lie of the enemy than that, that somehow we have to choose between masculinity and Christianity, because there is absolutely nothing more masculine and more necessary in this world than men to be men of God. If not, for who's going to fight for the things important in this world? And I wish some man would have told me that before I went to Afghanistan. Because of that, I believe I chose to deliberately remove God out of my life, or maybe say I could do that when I get older, later on in life. But right now, I have to be this warrior. I deliberately chose to put God out of my life, and I left a giant hole inside of my heart that over the next years I'd fill with hate and rage and anger and bitterness, and a darkness really took over me. Like I said, I didn't live on a base. I lived out in town. I ate dinner with the families, played soccer with the kids. I learned who the enemy was firsthand from the people of Afghanistan. And I went from this sense of patriotism to retaliate for 9/11 to really help these people who are truly oppressed, because of religious ideologies or live in torment and not free. And the things that happens to these women there and these young men and these little boys and little girls, the sexual molestation to these children, I began to hate the enemy, the Taliban, who they were. And everyone I worked with felt the same, especially the Afghans I worked with. And what we really engaged in was this Viking war culture mentality. And we were very driven, very intense, and extremely violent. My command over the 8 deployments I did was violently successful on every single mission that we faced with the Taliban. Whether it was capturing a bad guy or killing a bad guy, we were very successful. And I believe that violence and intensity works really well in combat, but it's not necessary. We could do the same mission and accomplish the same mission without that sense of anger and hate that drives us. In fact, not only is it not necessary, but it's not sustainable. It will destroy you, and it destroyed me. I would come home from Afghanistan, and I was still this very angry, intense guy. I would, it's a shame for me to say, but it's important for me to say every time that I speak, that my home was not a safe place for me to come home to. I'd be in Afghanistan, and 24 hours later, I'm back. Now I'm supposed to be a husband, a father, and Mr. Rogers, the friendly neighbor. Like, I was still this angry, intense guy, and I couldn't flip a switch and turn it off and be someone different. And my wife and children would walk around the eggshells. I'd throw fits over anything that when I didn't get my way, act like a 15-year-old boy that was throwing temper tantrum. I'd slam doors, punch holes in the walls, break things, scream at my kids like a Marine Corps drill instructor, and my wife too. It was not a good place. And over time, that anger began to get worse and worse and worse. One of the examples I'll give you is when I came home from Afghanistan for my little girl's birthday party. She was so excited I was going to be home. And she had a cake, and she's very opinionated. Now she's 20, in her 20s, she's even more opinionated. But she didn't like her icing on her cake, something so simple. And I remember just like totally flipping out. And I grabbed a handful of my little girl's birthday cake, and I picked it up and threw it against the wall and destroyed my little girl's birthday. And I remember thinking in that moment, like who does something like that? What kind of father behaves that way? And that's how I behaved all the time. I get in these moments where I knew I was out of control, but instead of stopping, because stopping would be like an admission of guilt, I would just justify it. Like, this is how I need to be. Like, I'm that's who I am right now. They just need to understand. I could change this later on in life. And those moments got worse and worse. Eventually, that anger started to manifest in these physiological symptoms. I'd have my arms would go numb. My face would go numb. Sometimes I'd feel like my throat was swelling shut. I couldn't breathe. Maybe like a 1,000-pound weight was on my chest, and I really literally felt like I was having a heart attack. And as there were these early signs of what we know to be panic attacks. And I didn't want to say anything to the guys I worked with because I knew they would think I was weak and I'd be pushed out of my community and my job. And so I pushed it down as far as I could and kept trying to do my job. Those symptoms got much worse. I had these moments during intense times in Afghanistan where I had what's called disassociation, where your mind feels like it's separate from your body. You remember things like a little bit delayed, and you almost see yourself like in a bird's eye view, like in a video game. There was other moments where I'd feel like I'd woke up out of a fog and have like hours of time missing. And even later on, even days missing. Towards the very end of my time there, I had an incident where we lost about 12 team members. 10 of them were Afghans, and you may not think it's as big of a deal, but remember these guys were the guys I lived with. They were, I ate dinner with their families, played soccer with their kids. They were my brothers, and I would have died for them, and they would have died for me. In fact, I believe they did die for me. And I love these guys. I knew them for 3 years. And so when that happened, I felt very responsible because they worked for me. And also, if I was hanging on by a thread in that moment, that thread was broken. And my last operation I went on was about 2 weeks long. And when I came back from that operation, I remember coming back and realizing that I didn't remember most of it. And I realized that I wouldn't only put myself in danger at that point. I was putting other people's lives and my teammates in danger as well. And so I finally had to speak up and say something. And when I did, I was brought home and put before a clinical psychologist and diagnosed with PTSD. And it was devastating for me at that time. I could speak for hours on PTSD and what it is and what it's not. How our body is not dysfunctional, but it's doing exactly what God created it to do because we see and do things sometimes that we're not meant or we're ever created to see and do. But the symptoms of that, while it's not a dysfunction, the symptoms of that are very, very real. And I was dealing with debilitating panic attacks And I don't want to minimize anybody's experience with panic attacks, but I hear people sometimes say, I was in traffic the other day and I had a panic attack. That's not what I'm talking about at all. Like, when I say I had debilitating panic attacks, like, imagine if you were handcuffed to the bottom of a swimming pool and drowning, and how desperate would you be to get one breath of air while you're just drowning and panicking? But you never drown. You never die. You feel that way 24/7. Like, you lit on fire and you just don't die. It's terrifying and a very hopeless feeling. And medications for me made me feel worse. It made me feel like I was being poisoned. I was very paranoid. And on top of that, I felt an extreme amount of shame because I felt I was given this opportunity to do the most important job that I could possibly be given in the war on terror, and I failed. I failed my teammates. I failed myself. I failed my country. I felt completely ashamed. And so my wife and my counselor were trying to find something for me to do to snap me out of it, to get me back, moving forward again. Since the medication wasn't working, the counseling wasn't working for me. And so he talked me into getting those wrestling mats and doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Now, I'd say I did it since I was little, but I'm still little. Like, I may look tall up here, but I'm not. I'm a little guy. So I did it since I was 5 years old. So they knew I did it since I was 5 years old, something I did my whole life. I was already fighting professional as an MMA fighter on the side in the military. So this was something that was good for me to get back on the mats and do. And I'll tell you the truth, when I got on those mats and trained, it felt like I found a cure. Because you can't think about Afghanistan and train or your buddy's going to beat you up. You have to be focused. So you have to unplug. Your mind has to be engaged. And I thought, man, I found the cure for this. And the truth is, it's really good for you. I still love it. I'm a third-degree black belt in lacrosse and Gracie Jr. I train all the time. In fact, I competed yesterday in the International Open. So I love jiu-jitsu. But, you could take something that's good for you, and you could abuse it. And that's what I did with this. And again, I still love it. Ministry is very hard, Pastor Jeff will tell you, and sometimes, especially ministry of veterans. And sometimes when I have a bad day, I get over to that gym, and I find like some 20-year-old stud, and I choke him out, and it makes me feel better. There's no better time, by the way, to share the gospel when you're about to choke someone unconscious. So I love it. But I took it out of its context. I was extremely successful. We opened a school right here in the Woodlands. Had like 1,000 students. So we financially were doing good. I started fighting professionally at some of the biggest levels of the sport. At one time, I was ranked number 6 in the world. I won a world title belt, fighting on pay-per-view and Showtime and MTV and all the big shows. And on the surface, it looked like everything was fine. But underneath that surface, our family was falling apart. I was still dealing with panic attacks, anxiety, depression. Our marriage was falling apart. And in that time, I made a decision to step out of our marriage and the relationships with other women. I ended up in a full affair. When it came to head, we decided to separate and filed for divorce. We sold our home right here in the Woodlands, moved in 2 separate apartments. My wife and I had 2 very different reactions. My wife actually came to this church, and she began to pray for me. You may think, how could she pray for me when I was doing this to her, portraying our family that way? She said she would pray, God, let me see Chad the way you see Chad. Let me love Chad the way you love Chad. Let me forgive Chad the way you forgave Chad. People tell me that she would stand against that wall right there and pray for me. And sometimes she would collapse crying because she was praying so hard and just so broken about what we were going through. I had a totally different reaction. Meanwhile, for me, I was in my apartment. I was like, I don't have to deal with this woman anymore. She didn't understand me anyway. I could finally be free of someone being around someone that don't understand what I'm going through. And I had this big fight on Showtime. I fought right there in a Toyota Center, packed Toyota Center. I remember I won this big fight in front of all these thousands of people. And after that, winning that fight, I came home to my apartment, right in Magnolia, and I started thinking how all the stuff I put my family through, and I thought, well, the common denominator of these problems is me. And so maybe my family would be sad without me, but they'd be better off. And unfortunately, that thought finds a home in the hearts of over 20 veterans every single day, and many outside the veteran community. Some of my family, some of my friends will be sad without me, but they're going to be better off. And I made a decision that I was going to take my life. I would sit in my closet I had a Glock 22 pistol, a 40 caliber pistol. I put my family pictures on the floor around me, and I try to build up the courage to pull that trigger. And every time I'd put that trigger to my that pistol to my head to pull that trigger, though, this overwhelming thought would come into my mind, kind of forecasting what would happen. And I had this vision that someone would find me. I have this vision of who was going to find me. Somebody's going to find you. You're going to be missing. Somebody's going to hear a gunshot. Someone's going to find you. And I knew the only other person that had a key to my apartment was my son, Hunter. And that thought of my kid finding me that way was enough to pump the brakes. But the next morning, I was back up trying to build that courage again. And there was one morning that I was in that closet with that pistol in my hand and heard a knock on my door. I wasn't going to answer it. And when Kathy, my wife, announced her voice, I took that pistol, probably out of shame, and I hid it. She would have never found it. It was my closet in my apartment, but I hid it under a blanket. Like a little kid getting caught doing something wrong. I answered the door. We engaged in an argument, pretty intense argument, heated argument. In the midst of the argument, she asked me a question that radically changed my life. She asked me how I could do everything I did in the military, making it into become a recon marine, training for these deployments, all the crazy stuff we did going to Afghanistan, training for these MMA fights, cutting weight, losing 30 pounds. Like sometimes I lose so much weight getting ready for a fight, I look like a Holocaust victim, like bones in my face. Like the discipline it takes to do the kind of things I did professionally in my life. She's like, how could you do all of that, and when it comes to your family, you'll quit? And I don't know about the rest of you men in here, but there's no more soul-cutting word to me than to be called a quitter. And she was absolutely right. I've been successful at professional things. When it came to the most important thing, being a husband, being a father, being a young 17-year-old kid that raised his hand on the yellow footprints at Marine Corps boot camp and said, I want to do something important with my life. I want to make an oath to myself, to my country, to the Marine Corps, and that I was going to do something important. I quit in all those things, including my own will to live. And I made a radical decision in that moment that I was going to pull things back together with discipline and work ethic. It had nothing to do with God at the time. But the one thing I did know, and I believe God gave me this intuition, was that I couldn't do it alone, and I couldn't do it with the people I surrounded myself by because I had no accountability in my life. Surrounded myself with everybody that told me what I wanted to hear, not what I needed to hear. And I knew I needed to hear some hard things, and I knew I needed some good accountability. So I asked my wife, is there someone at this church you're going to, Woods Edge, that can help hold me accountable to this decision? She called the church here, and they had an elder on call, Steve Toth. Some of you may know Steve Toth. And Steve was a small business owner at the time. He wasn't an MMA fighter or a recon marine or anything like that, never served in the military. But he was just the person I needed at that time in my life. I remember I met him at the Starbucks on Panther Creek, and we met at Starbucks, And I had this perfect plan. For those in the military, I had a 5-paragraph order, operational order of how I was going to fix my life, and it was really good. I was super proud of it, and I was like probably smugly like slid it over to Steve and was like, hey, check this out, but show it to my wife so I could win her back. And he put his hand on that paper, didn't even read it because he was rude, if you guys know him. he slid it back over to me and told me I was going to fail. And I remember being like, who is this jerk that just, and he said, he tapped on that paper. I'll never forget his words. He said, if this plan doesn't have anything to do with your relationship with God, I'm not going to waste your time, and I'm not going to let you waste mine. And that was exactly what I needed to hear. I tried everything. I tried the medication, the counseling, veterans programs. I tried professional success because we had been successful professionally. None of those things work. We have a saying at Mighty Oaks Foundation. If what you're doing isn't working, then why not try something different? Everything I tried didn't work. It was time for me to try something different. And so I gave Christ a chance. I surrendered my life to Christ. Beyond that decision, Steve mentored me for an entire year in biblical manhood. Through that year, I remember coming here every Sunday, sitting right in the front row, Wednesday worship services, prayer services being here. That was an amazing year for me, and I learned a lot that year. But one of the things I learned that was most profound was that all these bad things that happened to me, and there were some bad things, I shared just some of them with you, those things, as bad as they were, did not lead me to be in that closet with my pistol in my hand. What led me there were the choices that I made in response to those things. And I never lost control of the ability to choose. And look, it may sound cliche, but it's the only way I really know how to say it. I didn't have to let my past define my future. I could choose a different future moving forward. And I did through aligning my life with the life that God intended me to live, intentionally aligning my life with biblical principles. And in doing that, I began to find restoration in my own brokenness and my anxiety and depression with PTSD, in my marriage and family. I began to find hope for the first time in a very long time. And ultimately found what I sought and needed my whole life, and that was purpose. And that purpose is something that we have to have in our life. We're created to have it. Without purpose, we wither up and die. If you want to know why 20 veterans take their life every day, it's not because of what they seen or did. It's because they had purpose. They had a mission, a very clear mission. One day they woke up and they felt like their purpose was gone. Mark Twain says it like this: the two most important days in a person's life are the day that they're born and the day that they find out why. When Steve Toth introduced me to life I was created to live, and I finally stepped off that X, I found the purpose that I was created to live. And it's to be here today and share God's story in my life, because it's the story in all of our lives if we choose to step into a relationship with him. And that purpose really manifested in the founding of Mighty Oaks, which, as Pastor Jeff said, we were in no way qualified to do this. God just put a deep burden on my heart to say, hey, you're not the only one. I thought I was the only one dealing with this. I wasn't the only one. So many others are struggling with this. At the time, 22 suicides a day. 80% divorce rates in our military community. People would be diagnosed with PTSD and dealing with the same thing I was dealing with. It was like if I was dying of cancer and Steve Toth gave me the cure, you can't keep something like that yourself. I had a deep burden on my heart to share what I discovered with others, and we felt compelled to do it. I remember reaching out to Pastor Jeff, and he's like, people were telling me to wait. And then I remember of all the people, Pastor Jeff was the first one to say, I think this is real, and I think you should do this. And I remember coming up here on a Wednesday night prayer service, and Pastor Jeff really just given his position in front of the church and commissioned us as a ministry to go forth and do this. And God did the rest. I can never take credit for what's happened over the last 10 years because I'm not that smart, not that capable. God's brought just amazing provisions of the right people and the right circumstances to bring so much hope and so much healing to thousands and thousands of veterans. 4,000 people have come through the program, spoken over 150,000 active duty troops. I've been in the White House, worked directly with the president, testified before Congress and Senate, working on Senate bills to bring policy of veterans programs back into the VA and DOD, which has been gone for a very long time, but bringing faith-based programs and solutions back into the DOD and veteran systems. It's been absolutely incredible to be part of that. And we are really at Mighty Oaks, I believe, just getting started, and have so much amazing work that we get to do, and I'm so blessed to be a part of it. And I thank this church, thank Pastor Jeff and Gail for believing in us and the call that God put on us and continuing to support us. This church has supported us from day one in this effort, and I'm so thankful for that. God's promise of hope and restoration isn't reserved for combat veterans. You got to know that while I'm here. It's not reserved for combat veterans. It's for everyone. There's a million ways in this world that you could be hurt, that you could lose hope, that you could lose purpose in your life, that you get off track. But I'm really convinced that there's only one way to get well and only one way to find hope again and purpose, and that's through a relationship with Christ. there's life in general, even outside the military, is hard. And we're all going to find ourselves on the X and time to time in our life, whatever you're struggling with, whether it's anger or depression or lack of purpose or hopelessness, whatever it is, know God's promise for you. Jeremiah 29:11, "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you, not to harm you, plans to give you a hope and a future." That promise is for each of us, to give us hope and direction beyond the X's in our life. But it all starts with the relationship between you individually and Jesus. And if you're not there in your life, if you're not there and you don't know where even to begin, well, that's the first step in your journey, is to make a decision, just as I did in that Starbucks coffee shop right on Panther Creek. Just make that decision without it, maybe even reckless. You might even know what it means to step into a relationship with Christ and begin that journey. I pray you'll make that choice today, and I really challenge you to really evaluate and inventory your life. And if what you, and now the same question I had to ask myself, if what you're doing isn't working, then why not try something different? Why not give Jesus a chance? What do you have to lose? You have nothing to lose and everything to gain. In fact, you have eternity to gain for you and the people around you. If you made that decision today in your heart and you feel compelled to do that, as Pastor Jeff closes, there'll be some prayer partners up here, and come tell them that's what you want to do, and they'll pray with you and give you some guidance. If you're online, there's a little thing at the bottom you could click online, and then the church will contact you and help you through that journey. And I pray personally that you'll make the decision today. Thank you guys so much, and God bless you. Thank you to Pastor Jeff and Gail. Thank you for being here today. Love you guys. Thank you guys.